WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Yes, welcome to Monday Night Talk. I will do my best to get through the program as it finally caught me. It finally caught me, Joe Rossi. Joe Rossi sitting in. Joe
the
will be
sick bug.
It's beyond like the sick bug, like because I get like a double ear infection. So everybody who talks, like hearing Christine James do the news, it was like very. Even though she has an excellent voice, it had like a little like a
tinniness to it,
like a cartoon, like when you're talking. Yeah. Well, no, I wouldn't go Charlie Brown, but it's like everything. When I normally, it sounds like it's like sped up a little bit. Very interesting. So,
well, at least you didn't have the flu, which I'm just getting over.
No, but I had the bronchitis, and I have the bad cold that keeps coming back and forth. So, Ben will guide me. Ben will be my safety net this evening.
Kevin, you might not be able to hear because of your ear infection, but I can hear all the tiny violins out in the radio world playing for you right now.
It's like a big symphony.
Yeah,
it's really
exists.
Cool.
That's exactly what it is.
We got a fantastic show. Joe, of course, like I said, love having Joe in when he does the NFIP updates, and we know that this is thing that it's, you know, as far as the can is kicked, we usually wait that long before we kind of walk up to it and say, Joe, what has Congress decided to do at this point with the National Flood Insurance Program? And knowing that we are a radio station that serves many of the coastal communities, I feel it's a vital conversation. Mm. And I hear from a lot of the listeners who are like, it's good that you have Joe on. Joe is somebody who he knows his stuff. And I'm like, please don't tell Joe that. I will never fit his head out of the studio door after he hears that because it'll just...
That is true.
It'll inflate.
Yep.
But Joe is... I can't think of anybody who is better than Joe Rossi. Joe knows his stuff as he is
Thank
the chairman.
You, Kevin.
Of the, I say that begrudgingly, of course, but that's very true. You are, of course, also the chair of the Marshfield Citizens Coastal Coalition, which is kind of this, you guys are revamping your style. Like
we're last time. Yep, we're moving into becoming the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition, and we're just about all done with our rollout.
Remember, we're just teasing them with an appetizer. Don't give them the entree prior to doing the traffic. So other than Joe, we'll have Brockton City Councilor Wynn Falwell. Now, this is kind of a counter. You remember last week we had Mayor Bill Carpenter, as we kind of had an exclusive conversation with the mayor about an announcement he had made at Bridgewater State University about the city of Brockton delving into adult recreational marijuana, that there was legislation being filed with the city council, and it would go through the process, so to speak. Well, we'll have a chance to hear from Wynn Falwell. We'll get his take on it. Also, we got a new segment, and it was something that was proposed. The name of the segment is called The Gloves Are Off. And it happens to be with two individuals who have sought office here in the South Shore who proposed kind of doing an honest, goodness kind of a conversation in regards to what they feel is wrong with politics in general. And hopefully it'll be an evolution of our segment we used to do, Joe, the Red versus Blue.
Yes.
A lot less screaming, though. A lot less people yelling and screaming over each other because they think the other person is wrong. So we'll look forward to that conversation. A couple of candidates who are running for office will be joining us. We have East Bridgewater Selectman John Margie. We'll be on the program along with Greg Eaton. Greg actually picking up the mantle as Peter Drosos has decided to step away from running for the 7th Plymouth District. Mm. Now what's happening is Greg Eaton is stepping into the void, so he will be the Republican running. Folks may or may not know also is Mike Sullivan's daughter has also taken papers out. I think it's is it Alice?
I don't know that area.
Allison, might be Allison Sullivan has pulled papers. So we'll speak with Greg about that race. And then it's too bad that you can't stay because you have things that are going on.
I do.
We have NASCAR legend Larry McReynolds. Larry Mack. You know him as an announcer, but he's also a guy who has been a crew chief with some big names in the past.
He has. He's got a championship with Dale Earnhardt Sr., I believe.
I think he led him to Daytona, too, right?
Yes, he did. Yes, actually, that is correct.
All right. So we're going to put a little bit of we're going to put a bookmark in this part of the conversation. Just for a moment, we'll come back with Joe Rossi.
But hey, it's Jeff from Brennan Smoke Shop. I'm really striving to be the best smoke shop on the South Shore and South Coast in Massachusetts. If I'm not meeting that expectation, please let me know. And you can do so by private messaging me on Brennan Smoke Shop's Facebook page. The second you press send, it pops up on my smartphone and I will respond to you immediately. If we ran out of your product, you want to order a product, message me on Facebook. If there's anything our employees could do better, please message me on Facebook. If there's an employee that's gone above and beyond your expectations, please message me on Facebook. Honestly, I feel really good about the people that I have working for my company. If we can be better, let me know. Message me on Brennan Smoke Shop's Facebook page. Brennan Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island, New Bedford. If you're not happy, you want to talk, or you want to complain to somebody, message me directly on Brennan Smoke Shop's Facebook page.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, Joe, we can pick up where we left off as we have Joe Rossi in studio for the first segment of Monday Night Talk. Just a quick note, again, if you miss any of the segments, I am working on some of the back episodes of Monday Night Talk. Monday Night Talk, not only found on the website, but also available in iTunes. All 900 episodes.
Or 900?
900.
Oh, my God.
Never taken anything down. It's almost like I'm hoarding these shows on Podbean and on iTunes.
I'm impressed. What are we going to do what are you going to do for the 1,000th episode? Should be in the next 2 years or so.
It could be. Well, it depends. Don't forget, when I used to, there was a time when I used to segment the show. So what I would every guest would be their own podcast. And that became a lot of work because I usually do a lot of the post-production.
Sure,
So it was just easy just to kind of
put them all in one. Yeah.
The whole show. Could I do better and put like when the next guest starts? Sure, I could. I could. The one thing that was beneficial from having it where it's individual, I would be able to track who the guests and some of their followers and some of the people who would tune in for the conversations. Mm. When we would do the forums, I'd have an idea that these were the things that listeners were.
Well, I think putting the whole show up there is fine.
You think so, Joe?
Yeah, no one listens anyways. Zing, just had to get you on that one.
Oh, aren't you the zing bot?
Well, I did want to make sure that we talked a little bit about what's going on, because there's a series of important meetings that the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition has organized for not just the South Shore, but for the entire Cape as well. And we did this because, you know, we had been planning actually after the January storm, when we got all that flooding, to do something in regards to post-storm outreach, right? We had so many people come to us and say, you know, what do we do? Our house has a foot of sand in it. You know, our house has wave damage. We were 10 streets back from the water and we still got flooding, and now we've got damage we've never seen. What do we do? What do we do? So all these unknowns. And, you know, surprisingly, and this is no fault of the local communities, there's a void of bringing the information to flood victims to make sure that they get the information, not just the victims, also the people that have to service those victims, like realtors, community officials, you know, people that are in our society and daily life that need to connect the dots for some of the people that just don't have the right information.
I think it bodes me asking you this, as you, where you said that the name has been changed to Massachusetts from Marshfield.
Yeah.
How much work are you doing north of Boston? Do you find yourself
where
you're going to have to expand the role and serve folks in Gloucester? And
that's a great question. Yeah.
I mean, how much more homework and how much more is on your plate or on your organization's plate?
Well, I that's a great question, and I think that was one of the big considerations when we were moving in this direction, was our board's going to have to expand to include more people regionally, and we actually made that first step. And while we haven't voted on her board position yet, we have a renowned coastal geologist that is joining our board of directors from the Cape. And so that was kind of our first big step in moving to that regional capacity. Our second move was when we were planning these outreaches, and actually this was born out of the storms in March. We decided we would hold several on the North Shore. And so while we don't have them hard on the books yet, we know we'll have at least one outreach north of Boston to address some of the post-flooding concerns. So yes, we are working on truly branching out. And even before this, and one of the thrusts into changing the name to Massachusetts was that we've already done education for land surveyors, Mass Association of Insurance Agents, and those are well outside of the South Shore region. And so we really wanted to make sure that our name reflected what we do locally and regionally, but then also nationally. You know, we're really focused on the acronym MCC, and our new logo that we're working on really reflects the acronym more than anything, because we're working with some national companies and we're working with some national stakeholders to bring services that will service the entire country wherever you are, not just our locality here.
How do you do this? How do you, where you're expanding your role as an organization, how are you doing this financially? Is this something where you may look to seek grants to be able to offer these services and some of these forums that you do?
That's another great question. You're full of great questions tonight, Kevin. So the first thing is the grants. That's a great question. We are actively pursuing or interested in pursuing some grants that will focus really on assessing our resiliency. And I think there's a lot of grants now because there's a lot of attention being put towards coastal resiliency. And so that's one of the directions we're going, but we have been so fortunate in partnering with organizations that are doing a lot of free work for us. And so when we start to offer services like map identification services and risk scoring and risk identification services that are going to be extremely well priced considering the market that's out there, they're developing the tools and implementing them for us for free, so that in turn, when people are purchasing our new services that we're rolling out this year, we will generate some type of revenue to continue our mission. And I think that's the one thing that myself and the board of directors have really kind of grappled with very closely, which is, why do we want to bring in the additional revenue, and what do we want to do with that as soon as it starts coming in? And I think it's very easy to say that what we want to do is just grow what we do from an outreach standpoint, right? Right now we're doing in-person outreaches. We're going out doing these types of outreaches, which I'll give detail to in a minute here. But we want to be able to do that digitally, right? We want to be able to do videos. We want to be able to do education on our website. We want to be able to do the type of technology upgrades that require heavy resources. And so in order to do that, we've got to start somewhere, and that's where our service end will start to help us develop.
And this is strictly just for residential and commercial insurance and if folks seeking claims and all the above, in regards that you don't have any kind of municipal ties that are part of this either, are
well,
they?
You know, our history has shown that we educate four main groups really well, and that's the realtors, lenders, insurance agents, and general stakeholders. That would be the citizens and the policyholders. Those have been our four big focuses. But moving to a statewide program, and part of what we've done with these outreaches is actually partnered with the communities that we're going to be in getting those community officials involved as well. Because at the end of the day, the community officials are going to be the ones that usually make first point of contact when there's a major disaster. And so they need to be just as involved as all the other stakeholders in the discussion. So while in the past, we have done some education and outreach to communities with the municipalities themselves. We're more focused on that now than ever. And not just the municipalities. At our outreaches that we have right now in the South Shore and the Cape, we have state agencies that are participating as well. So moving to a statewide and regionally wide organization has really broadened the partnerships that we're able to have. And we actually have some announcements coming later in the month where we're doing some work with FEMA as well. And so kind of having some of that dialogue with them in discussions is really going to help at the end of the day our stakeholders.
I have to ask you this. Somebody who works well with elected officials, over the past couple of years, we have lost a couple of big names, people who have been, I think, helpful.
We have.
In trying to call attention at State Senator Bob Hedlund, who is now Mayor Bob Hedlund yep. in Weymouth. And just as recently as last week, State Representative Jim Cantwell now being kicked upstairs as he's now working with U.S. Senator Ed Markey.
Yep.
Losing two big individuals like, I mean, these are figures who I think helped call to attention some of the issues, especially when it came to getting those flood maps in order.
Sure. Well, and I think you made a great statement, Kevin, is that the people that were in were in certain positions at one time have moved to different positions and are still exactly and are still well in the fold, and if actually more helpful now than they ever have been. You take a look at Senator, now Mayor Bob Hedlund. We're actually working with his office to hopefully hold one of our outreaches in Weymouth. So that's still a real big piece of what they do, and there's a lot of flooding issues up in some of those eastern parts of the town. Then you look to Representative Jim Cantwell, who's going to be working for Senator Ed Markey. I mean, there couldn't have been a better position for somebody who has done so much work on the issue of coastal resiliency and flood insurance to now be at the national level, where have been working with at the national level from an insurance industry standpoint for several years. So being able to work with Jim at that level now will be extremely helpful. And then in their spots, we have very qualified candidates. And in Bob's place, we had Senator Pat O'Connor, who's very qualified and has actually, we're working with Senator O'Connor now since he's working in both capacities as filling in for Jim and being a state senator. We're actually advocating that the state establish a either grant or low interest loan program to help elevate or eliminate buildings that are repeatedly flooded. So there's still a lot of new people and good places and old faces and even better places. And so that's the way that we look at that.
Again, you're listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD World Wide Web, 959WATD.com. And of course, anytime that you have any questions for our guests, well, we know we don't have a call-in type of a mechanism here. You know, we send your questions or thoughts or suggestions for future guests to Monday Night Talk at gmail.com. And as we're talking with Joe Rossi, who is the chair of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition.
Yes.
He likes that MCC thing.
I do. I do.
Working on the logo
You talk about people graduating. We, as a coalition, have graduated.
From Marshfield, the citizens, yeah. To Massachusetts. Let's continue to graduate the conversation as we're talking about Senator Markey. And where do things stand in regards to the National Flood Insurance Program? when it comes to the federal level, and sure. and it being something that is continually will be funded and recognized by the Trump administration.
Well, yesterday, from an administrative standpoint, the program premium increases went into effect, as they do every April 1st, and they increase by 8% on average. And so that's getting headlines now. We've been talking about this for the last 6 months when we found out about those mm-hmm. increases. The administration's also making some changes without going through Congress. They're eliminating the amount of money they pay insurance companies to implement the flood program. That's a big deal because it reduced the costs for the flood program just a little bit by about 1 percentage point, but it's a big deal. They're also doing something very interesting administratively. They're eliminating a non-compete clause so that the companies that sell federal flood insurance can now sell private insurance at the same time. And this is important because it's moving the program in a direction where there's a partnership between the public and private industries. And so we're going to see that evolve. And then finally, congressionally, the program was extended to July 31st. This is a big deal because the budget is September 30th. So it decouples the federal government spending from the National Flood Insurance Program, which requires a standalone bill now in order to either extend the program or reauthorize the program. My sources are telling me that there will be some type of longer extension to the program with reforms by July 31st. So there's some hope there that something will actually get done.
And what I'd like to do from time to time when you are here is to remind the folks who are listening some of the key things, because just because it's April 2nd, it does not mean, did you not see what happened today? It snowed. And
yeah.
New England is notorious for its weather.
That's right.
And there are chances that we could see, you know, days of rain.
Yep.
And with that, you see flooding.
Yep. Just last summer, the Cape had two events where it rained 6 inches in just several hours.
There you
and
go.
That constitutes a major storm.
I believe that Ben, my producer, has a question.
You know, and not so much a question, but an observation of just how strange today's weather actually was. This morning, it was an absolute whiteout condition in between Weymouth to Plymouth. That was my commute. By the time I got to Plymouth around 10 o'clock, it was a complete and total covering of everything. And by 1 p.m., you could never even told it snowed.
Yep.
It was gone.
Yeah. So weird. Not even wet roads or puddles. Nothing.
It yeah. was like magic.
Just gone.
Yeah. Well, and I do want to, before we run out of time here, Kevin, I want to make sure I talk about our outreaches a little bit, because this is extremely important for our homeowners and our stakeholders. So the audience for our, we're doing two outreaches on the books, and we will actually be doing more, but these are the two we have scheduled. And the attended audience is affected stakeholders, which includes realtors, community officials, affected residents, and more. The first outreach will be in Marshfield this Wednesday, April 4th, from
Perfect
6
timing.
To 8. Yep, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ventris Memorial Library's new program room. That's 15 Library Plaza in Marshfield. And the second one will be on Cape Cod. That's the Cape Cod outreach, April 11th. From 6 to 8 p.m. at the Cape and Islands Association of Realtors office at 22 Mid Tech Drive in West Yarmouth. Now, the agenda is essentially the same for both. There'll be a presentation on flood issues and what to do after a storm with claims
Good.
And whatnot.
Good.
Then we'll have the Department of Conservation Recreation in attendance, along with Brian Baer from, he is the executive director of the Elevated Studio, a nonprofit that deals with elevating homes. And so we'll have them both there for an expert panel that will be there to answer questions from the audience. And so if there are questions, we'll have those resources available. And then after those presentations and question and answers of the expert panel, we're going to have a workshop area where people can actually get some one-on-one guidance with the people on the expert panel. That's very similar for both outreaches. There'll be some additional resources that come to some outreaches that don't come to others. The bottom line is people will be able to come, find out what to do after the flood, learn about grants, learn about what's going on with the coastline. But importantly, because we've partnered with some communities in doing this and some state agencies and local resources, we're actually going to be able to have some of these officials there to talk about what the localities are doing in response to the storms. And so make sure you're there in Marshfield this Wednesday from 6 to 8 at the library, and the 11th on Cape Cod at the Cape and Islands Association of Realtors from 6 to 8. to participate and be there, especially if you were affected.
Website, if folks need further information.
Yep, we ask people to go to the website. It is NoFlood, that's K-N-O-W, so it's noflood.org. Go there to our events page, find out more about this, these events, and find out more about us.
There he is, Joe Rossi, chair of the Marshfield, Massachusetts. Massachusetts Coastal Coalition, serving you, not only the fine folks here on the South Shore, but expanding now to the Cape, the North Shore, and beyond. That's all the time with Joe. We thank you, Joe, for coming in, as you always do.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You are due up for some co-hosting duties soon.
I am. You always throw that in there.
Keep that in mind. Just a reminder, second hour, our new segment, The Gloves Are Off, with Brian Cook and Stephen Gill, as well as Larry McReynolds, NASCAR legend, will be joining us. But after the break, we'll check in with Brockton City Council Win Fowl. You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
Be a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
And we are back here on Monday Night Talk, 95.9 FM in Marshfield. And recently we had a conversation with Brockton Mayor Bill Carpenter in regards to adult recreational marijuana. And it's an interesting conversation because there are many communities up until this past weekend who were scrambling to put either a bylaw or a ban or a moratorium in place in regards to adult recreational marijuana, depending on how that community voted during the ballot question that was put forth in 2016. And so joining us to kind of give the inside of what the Brockton City Council, their thought, and with the city of Brockton, since the news came out that Brockton may be looking at entertaining retail sales and cultivation, we have at-large Councilor Win Fowell. And what's fantastic about having Councilor Fowell on is that Councilor Fowell is a man who has won. He has worn many, many hats in the city of Brockton, not only as somebody who served his time in law enforcement, not only somebody who sat on the school committee, not only somebody who was the mayor of the city of Champions, but now I don't think there's anything else unless he wants to do planning board or ZBA, but now he is on the city council. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin, for having me on this evening. It's a pleasure to join you.
Give me your thoughts on, again, somebody who you know, you spent your time as a member of law enforcement in the city of Brockton, and there was a time that it was just totally illegal to possess marijuana. We had a war on drugs in the 80s, all drugs besides, you know, marijuana. And now where it has slowly crept into society where it's not something that is criminal, and it's now something that's being more and more accepted. How do you accept? How do you take that as somebody who has worn that once worn that hat?
Well, it's actually quite humorous in some ways, because when I began my law enforcement career, possession of marijuana was actually a felony.
Right.
And then the legislature changed it, and it made it a Class D controlled substance, so it became a misdemeanor. And now we have transcended all of the history of marijuana, and the voters opted to legalize it in 2016. And I actually understand that. I think a lot of people were troubled by the fact that people were going to jail for marijuana possession or marijuana distribution. I think in some cases, if you're selling to children, you should do some time. But I think people were genuinely worried that that was not a good use of our correctional facilities, and you ought to be putting away the people who are breaking into houses and committing armed robberies and cracking down on the violent criminals. So I get it, but it really is interesting to think that in this state we're going to embrace an entirely new industry, an industry that never existed before, was illegal, is still illegal under federal law, which I find fascinating, because to say that the president is mercurial and can change his mind at any given moment, it would be very interesting if suddenly he woke up one day and said, you know, I'm going to leave the individual users of marijuana alone, but I'm going to crack down on the people that are producing products and selling it by the ounce. And I don't know what the response would be from the state or what the legal ramifications would be. So there are a lot of things to factor into any decision making on the whole question of sales points for medical marijuana and adult use marijuana products.
It's interesting that there are many communities, as I said at the introduction of this segment, that communities, especially the ones who their residents voted in favor, you know, more so a majority voted in favor than not so much, that there are neighboring communities, I want to say Stoughton, Whitman, Bridgewater, Easton, those are the ones that I've heard mentioned. I know for a fact that Whitman just recently passed something. It was something that I actually reported on as they took the final step to do a townwide election following a special town meeting, where they wanted to kind of interpret what the voters' intent was in 2016. Was it to so much say, yes, all across the board, to sell it, to grow it, and to, you know, be able to possess it? Or is it just so much not to make it a crime if somebody is caught with that on their person? And they went the full throng to, you know, make sure that it was something that was in their zoning, and there was a protective zoning bylaw put in place. Looking at Brockton could have done the same thing. I don't know how it would work out, where it's a different form of government, where it's not a town meeting form of government, if it would be something that the city council and the mayor, how that would work out. But it seems as though the mayor had recently put forth an announcement during an event at Bridgewater State University that the city of Brockton is actually that is looking at it, and this is in the mayor's eyes, and that he actually had a city council that was filing legislation to possibly look at zoning and setting stuff up for this to happen.
Well, the council will still have to examine zoning issues and business regulations that need to be established. I'm going to go back to what you mentioned about some communities opting not to have any sales points, not to have any marijuana sales in their community. And I'm wondering if perhaps it's a wait-and-see approach. Because obviously every community can use additional revenues. Every community would love to have more programs in their schools and enhanced public safety services for police and fire and emergency management and infrastructure repairs to roads and water mains and all of the other things that make up the livability in a community, library services. So I'm wondering, and we'll probably never know, if some of these communities are saying, okay, it's brand new, somebody's going to go forward with this, let's see what the impact is. And if the impact is positive, if in fact there are substantial revenues that are derived from marijuana sales, and those sales and customers coming into a community don't take away a lot of municipal services, we'll get involved later on. We'll change our zoning, or we'll put something before town meeting, or in a couple of years we'll put something before the voters to see if they want to change their mind. And maybe the communities who are opting in at this point are the guinea pigs, so to speak.
Yeah, and, well, it's interesting, as I said, well, following the news of those communities that decided not to and asking why they decided to go in the direction that they went in, I actually like what you just said as a wait-and-see approach. I did hear from officials in those communities that said that it was so broad the way the ballot question was laid out, you didn't know exactly what it was, and so the idea was is to put something forth to the residents just to check and see that they want it to be okay across the board, or that they just want to make sure that it wasn't something that was criminal and it was going to affect, you know, some of the folks who did indulge at a later date. If they are trying to go out and get a job, it wouldn't be something that would hinder them, so to speak. So it's interesting that you laid it out in that aspect. I didn't even think of it like that, but it's not like it's irreversible that if you put a ban in place that you cannot go in and amend that legislation, correct?
Well, that's correct, sure. A town could hold a ballot question at a future town meeting or a town election, or a city could have a change of heart and opt in if they have so far opted out. Obviously, and the council really hasn't had a chance to discuss it in detail. We will later tonight when we review some orders that were filed by the mayor with Councilor Monahan's help. But I will say that one of the comments that I hear all over the city is, we've got to make sure we protect kids. We've got to make sure they don't get exposed to these products and get their hands on these products. And, you know, let's be honest, there are some minors who get alcohol from various sources, and sometimes they get caught, and they get, you know, either prosecuted or driven home, and once in a great while you'll catch a licensed liquor establishment selling to a minor. You definitely don't want that to happen with marijuana products. So I think that's one of the biggest unknowns is, will we be able to sufficiently control this and protect young people from getting hold of marijuana products? And you know, the school superintendent here in Brockton mentioned recently they've already had some incidents where children have come to school and unfortunately they've ingested some marijuana products and they have to go to the school nurse or they have to be driven home by their parents, or I'm not so sure we didn't have a couple actually go for medical treatment. But the whole issue of protecting minors, I think for me, becomes paramount, and that probably goes back to my service on the school committee and in law enforcement.
I would also mention this, and this was something that I actually put right forth to the mayor, knowing the mayor has been a staunch advocate when it came to getting treatment for folks during this whole epidemic with opioids, that there are in the addiction community, in the community, for those who try to help those with addiction, there is an argument in regards to marijuana. There are many who see it as a gateway drug. There are some folks who do not see it so much as where there is a medicinal use to marijuana for pain. There is still that question. There's still that, I think, that discussion that's going on. What's your take on marijuana? Do you feel that it is a gateway, or do you kind of think it's the jury is still out with studies?
I think it really comes down to the individual. And again, I'm not saying that alcohol equates completely to marijuana, but, you know, there are some people who can go out and they can have a drink at dinner time and they're okay. There are other people who then become someone who comes home from work every night and has to have, you know, a six-pack or four or five glasses of wine. And it, you know, each of us individually, we have certain trigger points, and do I worry that there will be a percentage of people who will try marijuana and they'll feel so good that, hey, you know, what's next for me? Yeah, that could happen, but I'm not willing to say that that's an industry problem. I think based on what we've received so far, triggered a lot of research on a number of parts of for counselors, there really hasn't been a lot of research done in this. I mean, the legalization of marijuana started, I guess, out in Colorado or Washington State, and now it has spread eastward. You know, 10 years from now, we'll probably know more about what effect has legalization of marijuana had on the number of cases going into emergency rooms or medical care. But I'm not sure we have enough data right now, Kevin, to form a conclusion.
Again, we're speaking with at-large Brockton Councilor at-large, Mr. Wynn Farwell. We're talking a little bit about adult recreational marijuana and the recent announcement that it's something that the city may explore as a new industry in regards to generating revenue. I guess I would ask either yourself or anything you may have heard from your colleagues, what was the reaction when the announcement was made by Mayor Carpenter that this was something that the city was delving into? Was this something that was much anticipated, or was it a surprise?
Well, you may have read in some news media outlets that it was a surprise, because we were led to believe that we were weeks away from having anything substantive in terms of documentation, orders, ordinances, business regulations presented to us. And the night before the mayor made this grandiose announcement at Bridgewater State University, we were still led to believe that it wasn't going to be immediate. So it was a surprise, but you know what? That's behind us now. We've got to do our work as 11 elected officials and make sure that you protect the interests of the community, especially children, and try to make the best out of the fact that it's coming. We will have some recreational sales points in Brockton, and the issue will be where and how many and what reasonable regulations are you allowed to impose upon those who engage in that business. And of course, we'll be guided by the Cannabis Control Commission regulations, as well as any other reasonable ones that we can enact. So, and again, it's you know, I was a very boring kid. I got a police job when I was 19 down on the Cape, a summer patrolman, and that morphed into a full-time career in law enforcement. I can honestly say I never tried marijuana. As a matter of fact, I never smoked a cigarette. So I really don't get all the hoopla around it that, oh my God, I can't wait until I can go out and buy it legally and enjoy myself. I mean, if it's that good, you know, God bless people who find it that way, but I'm just dealing with the business of it, how to regulate a business and make sure that the interests of the city are protected and that we don't drain existing city services. We protect kids. We protect locations where kids would hang out, like public libraries, public parks. But the personal aspect of it, because people really are passionate about it, I don't get it, but that's okay. We'll do our work, and we'll make sure that Brockton is hopefully in the advanced process of doing the right thing for the new marijuana industry.
Probably one of my last questions before we say goodbye for this segment, or at least farewell. We never say goodbye, and that is, my understanding is that the City Council actually has put in place a moratorium until everything can be looked at. How long would the moratorium is that in place? And what work, you said tonight the City Council begins work, or at least looking at this?
Yes. We'll look at three orders tonight that have been filed by the mayor. We also have a newly filed moratorium order, which I think will put the ban in place for 6 months or until we finish all of our work. And that's just so that we're not hurried, that we don't miss something, that we take our time, not unduly delay, but we take our time in doing what we need to do to look at business regulations and zoning issues and public safety and public education issues. I would say for the next 4 or 5 weeks, the council will be very busy on this topic.
And this is on top of, you're right around the corner, budget season, already anticipating a deficit for the city budget. Of course, you're still anticipating the mayor's budget. You got to enjoy the busy times, yes?
Well, you do. You enjoy it in the sense that you know it's work that has to be done. You really don't enjoy having fiscal constraints, budgetary constraints every year.
Right.
But it is part of the process. Many communities go through it. trying to spend the available funding you have in the most responsible way becomes the paramount issue. I have sympathy for the mayor, all mayors who have to put forth a spending plan to their respective city councils, because there aren't many that have a lot of excess funds to do some creative things. It's really trying to maintain the level of services that you have now and then slowly in increments expand some other services for your residents. So it'll be challenging, but somehow we get through it every fiscal year.
And folks, that's experience speaking. As I said earlier on, as I introduced Mr. Falwell, he has worn all of the major hats in the city, from school committee to being the mayor, putting forth that budget to the city council, to now being the city council in wait for that budget to be presented to them to take a look at. Anything in closing in regards to this whole adult recreational marijuana discussion in the city of Brockton?
No, I think we've covered where we are right now. I think it will be an evolving issue. I don't think that you'll simply enact some zoning ordinances and some business regulations and then never revisit the issue again. Anytime you have something new, I almost make it akin to learning how to swim. You don't jump in the deep end of the pool and tell yourself everything will be all right. You're going to be able to master this. I think you start slowly and you proceed in increments until you get up to that level where you're fully comfortable and you know everything will be operating the way you want it to. And that will certainly be the case with this industry. It's brand new. It's something that probably many of us never thought would ever be on the plate to discuss. But I'm sure it'll get done. I think collectively we will make sure that we make it as successful as possible.
Council, I want to thank you for joining this evening prior to your city council meeting. And we'll look forward to more conversations with you and your colleagues down the road.
Thank you very much. Have a great night, Kevin.
Okay, there he is, at-large councilor in the city of Brockton, Wynn Fowell, joining us. We're going to step aside just for a minute. When we come back, more Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD-FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, the second hour of Monday Night Talk. And we got a very interesting segment. And I will tell you that one of my guests actually put the idea forth. We have in studio right now Mr. Brian Cook, attorney. He's been a candidate also for office. A couple of different times, and he'll kind of give a little bit of his bio before we get started. We have Mr. Stephen Gill. He also, I believe, is an attorney, and he has run for office in the past. Gentlemen, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
Thanks, Kev.
Hi, Kevin.
You guys are no strangers to this show, but Brian, I want to thank you for coming up with the idea, and I think I'd like for it to be a reoccurring theme. I will tell you, it's not different than other segments that we've done. We actually used to do a segment that used to be called Blue versus Red. But instead of it being a conversation piece, it turned into a screaming match with two folks who are on the opposite side of the aisle. And that doesn't make for good radio. We want to have good, competent conversation, honest conversation, especially when it comes to politics. And that was what you provided as a segment, Brian, is that you wanted to call this the gloves are off, a no-nonsense conversation about politics.
Well, it was largely the creation of two thought process. I think one of them is that every sports fan in New England would pay to have Bill Belichick do a press conference where he told them what he was really thinking. Mm. And I found during the campaign, the person that I had the best conversations with, excuse me, about things that mattered was Steve Gill. When I talked to other people, I got political speak. I got the answer they thought that people wanted to hear. But that's not what keeps people up at night. people are up at night because they can't pay their mortgage, or they hate their commute, or they're afraid their kids aren't going to get into school, or they can't pay for the nursing home for their parents. And that worries them, and that's what I think elected officials should be focused on. But instead, they give you the answer that they think will create a great soundbite. And the comment that I made to Steve that I stand by today is, take all the people who represent you if you live on the South Shore. Name one thing any of them have done that have made your life better. I can't think of a thing. So I found myself thinking after the election was over, which at the time I thought of as one of the greatest things I've ever done, which, as you know, had one of the more bizarre results in Massachusetts politics. And then I thought about what Steve went through during and after the election, and I thought, these are two people, you know, and I'm going to talk about myself and Steve, who educated themselves, went to college, went to law school, raised a family on the South Shore, and said, I'm going to give most of that up to serve. And I foolishly and maybe naively thought that there was going to be trumpets playing and they were going to line the streets with rose petals and say, thank you, thank you, thank you. Instead, what both of us got from our parties was, we don't want you to run. You've never run before. You're not part of the insider. And we found ourselves sort of scratching our heads thinking, really? Why do people constantly complain that there aren't enough choices? And then when you give them choices, the party tells you that you're not our choice.
If you would, for folks who don't recall or don't remember, kind of give us a breakdown as to what happened to you when you sought office. Sure. And what the office was.
Yeah. When I was in high school, or actually in college, I worked for Senator Alan McKinnon on the South Shore, and it sort of gave me the political bug, and I always thought about running. And there were people like Peg McKenzie and Norma Fenichetti who kind of ran the South Shore. But over the course of the 30 or 40 years it took me to actually get up a head of steam to want to run, I forgot or missed that the South Shore had changed. The South Shore had been a heavily Democratic, working class, police, fire, teachers, people who cared about Democratic values. And all of a sudden, somewhere along the line, that all changed. And maybe it was the Trump Revolution, but all of a sudden, the people from Weymouth were more Trump than they were Hillary. And I found that when I started to run, I was sort of told, well, we've already got somebody. And Joan Moschino had stepped out first, and she was going to run for the office. And the party sort of united behind her, intelligent woman from Hull who had gone to Harvard. And then Joan at some point decided to switch and go with the reps race instead of the Senate race. But our Secretary of State decided that he couldn't change the ballot because it would cost too much. So Joan's name continued to appear on the Senate side with mine, and Paul Gannon, who had run in the special election, chose not to run, claiming that he knew he would win in the end, which, in retrospect, I sort of scratched my head. But basically what happened was I was the only one running. I had 2,600 votes. Joan got over 3,000, and Gannon got 148. And when the caucus met to decide who would win, they didn't pick second place. They picked Paul Gannon third place, because they said that he had been a Democrat longer. The whole thing was a little confusing and a little disappointing because I had grown up in Weymouth, and the incumbent at the time after the special election was Pat O'Connor. And I thought, okay, let's look at this on paper. We've got a kid who lives in his parents' basement, who has only worked for state government, who's never really held a job on his own, who either attended but didn't graduate from college, running against someone who has a mortgage, has a family, went to law school, has two union parents. I think I've got a good shot. And I'm from Weymouth, which is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the district. But the party decided, no, we're going to go with a pro-life Democrat. And obviously, the end result was Pat O'Connor, which I guess confirmed my theory that the South Shore had changed and the Democratic Party had missed the boat and had lost one of the strongest Democratic districts in the state.
Steve, if you would, kind of give your plight and what happened with you as you actually filed for court action in regards to the ballot and how everything went forth.
Right. Well, as listeners may recall, I had thrown my hat into the ring during the special election cycle for the state Senate seat for the Plymouth and Norfolk district, which is the eight towns running from Weymouth all the way down to Duxbury. I had previously been registered as a Republican, and I remember that I had registered that way only because I was really an independent, an unenrolled person, and I wanted to vote in a primary, a prior election cycle, where you know how the Massachusetts election works for unenrolled folks. And by the way, it's funny because 80% of Massachusetts voters are unenrolled in a political party, which is to say that they are independent. But if you want to vote in a primary, and I always, you know, in my voting, I like to vote the person more so than the party. And I wanted to vote in this primary, and I wanted to support a Republican. So when I went to the vote in the primary, they make you choose there if you're unenrolled. So I just took the registered Republican, took the ballot, and went in just to vote in the primary, and had the intentions of switching back to unenrolled at some point. I just hadn't gotten around to it. Remember, I was a lieutenant commander in the Navy Reserve JAG Corps, and I had been coming on and off active duty for over the years for several periods of various length of time. So I was actually had been out of the state for a bunch of reserve duty. If you strung it all together, it was something like 4 months. Well, during that time, Bob Hedlund had run for, our former senator had run for the Plymouth Norfolk District, had run for Weymouth mayor.
Yep.
He won the election, and then, interestingly enough, secretly, on Christmas Eve of 2000, 2015, he secretly resigned, and nobody knew about it. It's Christmas Eve. I mean, end of the year, no one knows what's going on. I was actually out of the state. I came back, learned about these things, and said, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring to run. And unfortunately, the way the Massachusetts state law was written, by secretly resigning last minute on Christmas Eve of 2015, the law put the date that you had to choose your party if you wanted to run 75 days in the past. So I would have had to have had a time machine and foreknowledge of his secret resignation on Christmas Eve and go back in time and then unroll. So I was a Republican and I was stuck as a Republican. As you know, Patrick O'Connor, who was formerly the assistant or something to Bob Hedlund, got propped up as his heir apparent. So I wanted to run, and I started questioning this issue of, hey, this runs afoul of the First Amendment, your right to free association, the way the Mass statute is written. If there's a special election and a resignation takes place this way, it should have a special exception whereby you're given at least, 10 days or something to change your party or to get into the party that you want to run as. So I called all around the state. I spoke to 16 of the top election lawyers in the state, and they all told me, "Boy, you got a great case. We really think you should bring this." So, I was negotiating for 2 months with the Secretary of State's office, and just couldn't get any traction with them. And so I said, "All right, well, I got an attorney, and we went and filed the action in federal court." And unfortunately, the federal judge, there's a doctrine in the law called political question doctrine, and courts don't like to render decisions in cases that affect the other branches of government and the election process. So the federal judge did what federal judges do, is they basically sit on your case until the election is over, and then they rule, and it doesn't matter which way they rule because it's moot. It doesn't matter. You can't get your way. Now, Brian was stuck in a similar situation. He was unenrolled and wanted to run as a Democrat, but he got stuck by the same catch-22 that Hedlund had created. So I brought the suit. Other people were telling me, you're crazy to bring a suit against Bill Galvin. But, as we see here now, a year and a half later, who just brought suit against Bill Galvin last month for Massachusetts state election law violating the U.S. First Amendment of the Constitution is Bill Weld, former Governor Bill Weld. He's suing Galvin right now in federal court. Sure. Same issue I had, slightly different state law being attacked, but same violation of your federal First Amendment rights. So,
well, I think the issue that Steve raises is important because, as he noted, I went to the state Democratic Party when I decided I was going to run and said, you know, I'm excited about this. I've always wanted to do it. I said, I understand that Bob just declared that he's stepping down. And they said, well, you can't run as a Democrat. And I said, why? And they said, because you're not enrolled as a Democrat. And I said, well, I've voted as a Democrat my entire life. I've never voted any other way. And they said, well, you didn't enroll as a Democrat. And I said, I'm confused. In the old days, you would go in if you were an independent, and whatever you voted in the primary, that's what you became. And they said, no, that law changed a few years ago. So they told me that the only way that I could run was as an independent. And I did a press conference as an independent, but then I decided, no, I'm not an independent, I'm a Democrat. And so I withdrew from the special election. When I ran as a Democrat in the general election, in the actual election, the caucus decided, no, you had said you were an independent once, so you're an independent. I think, as Steve so aptly points out, most of the state of Massachusetts is unenrolled. Now, whether they don't know they're supposed to register or not, I'm not sure, but the unenrolled party, if it was a party, would beat the Republicans and the Democrats hands down. This has been largely a Democratic state for as long as most of us can remember. But the South Shore now is one of the strongest Republican strongholds in the state.
It does have pockets that are strong. And if I could just interject real quick here, a perfect example. You look at the special race to fill State Senator Tom Kennedy's seat. That was Jeff Deal and Mike Brady, both state reps. Jeff Deal won a majority of the district. The only community that I recall he did not win was Brockton. And Brockton is a Democratic stronghold. But he won, essentially, all the other communities. And some folks feel as though the way that race set up and the way the election set up for the Democrats was is that the city of Brockton was having a city election, and it was basically set up so that the city election coincided with the special election, essentially, and this is what folks will say out there, helping now State Senator Mike Brady. This is what people say.
Exactly. No, and you're right. And if you look at what happened in our race that Steve and I ran, Bob Hedlund didn't want Pat to have to run on the Democratic primary, which the state was all set up for. And because of that, he was able to push it to a special election, which would have brought more Republicans out. Either of us probably would have had a better shot to win if that had been the same day when a majority of the population was turning out anyway. But people had to turn out on a special election on a separate day, and that does require some effort on the voters' part.
It all sounds like a high school clique to me, is that, especially with your situation, you're somebody who you were, you know, somebody who was the top vote-getter in that primary, steps aside and decides that they want to go and be a part of the other race. The no-brainer would have been for the caucus to say, hey, this is the guy who is next in order. He should be the guy. He has proven that he was able to mobilize the votes. While he was not successful in defeating the person who's stepping, he's still second.
That would have been my thought. In the State House News Bureau ran an article saying exactly that. You know, how did the South Shore pick number three instead of number two? Now, I had conversations with some very powerful insiders who told me that this discussion with Paul Gannon had taken place long before he chose not to put his name on the ballot. And they said, if Joan stays on the ballot and if Joan wins, then we have a chance to put you into the seat. And that's exactly what transpired.
Let me ask you both this question, and that is there any kind of, is there anything that the elected, I should say elected, that the registered voters can do to fix the system, or is the system broken beyond repair? Steve?
I hope it's not broken beyond repair. What I think, and I think I'm like most registered voters in Massachusetts, is that, you know, we don't have to join a particular team and then blindly accept the slate that the team gives us to play. You know, we should be voting for the individual who is the credentialed individual who is, you know, hopefully a likable person and someone who we know is going to fight for us as a district, speaking only of the Plymouth and Norfolk district. But I don't know why people – it's funny. I got this real quick. The Cohasset, highly, highly Republican town, they went nuts voting for Patrick O'Connor because he was, quote, the Republican. Patrick O'Connor's first vote in office after he won the special election and was the freshman senator here, he voted on the bill that was put forth to amend the Massachusetts Constitution to put a 20% income tax penalty on folks making $1 million or more a year. If that isn't an anti, not only anti-Republican, but probably more of a progressive Democrat concept, and why was he supported blindly by, you know, these Republicans on the South Shore? The kid is not a Republican. He's just not.
Well, that I think is a great comment because Charlie Baker is not a Republican. Charlie Baker is a Democrat who ran as a Republican. We see in Massachusetts much more of a blurring of the lines than we see in West Virginia or Tennessee or in other places like Texas. What we see is there are certain issues you can't step back on. Pro-choice, even though people may be anti-abortion in their personal life or in their religious life, they know the law says that pro-choice is the law, and so they support it. Yet they're, quote, Republicans. They realize that working men and women, union people, police, fire, teachers, are a major voting bloc. So they support those issues. The Democrats have sort of lost that crowd because those people started thinking that the Democrats cared more about Ivy League graduates and elites that, you know, Hillary's world and Elizabeth Warren's world put together. But I was at an event the other night for Maura Healey, and every woman who had ever been elected in Massachusetts was there. And I was so impressed by the crowd that was there. And I was so impressed by Maura. And I think Maura is a person who not only is doing a real job because she's the Attorney General, so she's not just an elected official who's going to, you know, baby namings and ribbon cuttings. She's doing a real job. But she's also representing the issues that matter to the voters that voted for her. And again, I go back to my original comment. Please help me to name something that's happened in your life, if you live in the South Shore, that you directly thank your elected official for.
And I'm going to just kind of throw this out there again. That's Brian Cook and Stephen Gill. This is kind of a new segment that we're introducing to Monday Night Talk, and it's something I'd like to, every maybe 4 or 5 weeks, have you gentlemen be a part of, depending on your schedules, and have this open dialogue, and it could be something that we can continue. While we can't really talk about everything during this segment, I think over a series of segments, we can really tackle a lot of different ones from the local level as to what we're seeing here on the South Shore. And this is while this seems like low-hanging fruit, it's ripe for the picking because it is election season. You have state reps that are up for election. You got right about now, March, April, May is when you have a lot of the local elections for selectmen, or depending on the type of government, it could be mayor or city council, town council, what have you. But the idea of this conversation is, again, to kind of look at the political, be honest, have a good conversation about politics with two guys who have been in the scrum, out there, knocking on doors, only to be told that, yeah, you don't have the timber at this time to be leading our team. And I'm going to kind of ask this question. We got a couple of more minutes left here in this. And I'm going to take this on a grander scale, guys, if I can, to ask this one of these last questions that I'll ask you. Do you think that the whole thing with parties has kind of run its course? You look at the 2016 presidential election and the two candidates that were put forth, and I heard it more than one time or two times that the folks who were being put up for leaders, we look back through our history who leaders are, who the leaders are. I'm sure I can ask both of you, and you could pick off the top of your head some of the leaders that you remember that embolden you as an individual and that have led our country to through greater and grander times. But is it time, instead of voting for the party or who the party puts up, that you vote for the person?
I think that's a brilliant question, because if we look at the national election, it was so close that people were really conflicted as to who am I going to vote for. Yeah. One wins the Electoral College, the other wins the popular vote. And I do believe that there's a feeling that wouldn't it be great if a John Glenn or a Bill Bradley or some of these other people, Colin Powell, ran for office. But someone once said to me, and I took it, you know, I thought about it for a while, they said, anyone that runs for office doesn't deserve to win, because your ego has to be so great to think that you can come in and lead us, that maybe you're not exactly who we want. Mm. Or the person who really could lead you says, I don't know, in my humility, I don't think that I could actually make that jump or consider myself the most talented person for the job. But I think, like anything else, choice matters. And my hope is, whether it's the party or some other filter, that anyone who steps forward to run will be told, thank you for trying, you know, best of luck to you.
Stephen?
Yeah, I would love to believe that it is time to vote for the individual, but you know, the parties have been so entrenched for so long that they will not give up that power. They will thrash to the dying day. You know, it's funny. Our second president of the United States, John Adams, said that his biggest fear was that the two political parties would be the ones to fight back and forth to run this country, and he thought that it would be a disaster. And he was talking about his party, which was like the Federalists and the Whigs, but I mean, you know, whatever you want to call it, same thing.
And it's funny you mentioned the Federalist and the Whigs back in the early formation of our country. But we haven't had a real third or fourth party, so to speak, because the two primary parties that we know, you know, won't let anybody else in. They won't let them elbow in and be a part of the process.
Well, they use the law against third parties.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, well, gentlemen, I want to thank you. What I want to do is I'm going to put a bookmarker in on this chapter. Anything you want to say quickly in closing for us to set up our next segment in the next couple of weeks?
I think I come back to the great de Tocqueville quote, which is, American democracy is the worst system that there is, but it's better than anything anyone else can imagine.
Steve?
Hey, we're going to have Jim Cantwell's seat in the 4th Plymouth District is up for grabs now, and we're going to have an independent by the name of Nathaniel Powell running from Marshfield. Please, folks, take a look at him and seriously think about it. As a firefighter, he's a businessman, great guy. I think you should take a look at him.
Excellent. And again, great conversation here, guys. And with your permission, definitely, let's do this again. Let's revisit it in a couple of weeks. Have a nice primetime segment like this. And again, continue stimulating the conversation so maybe folks will give a third or fourth party candidate an opportunity, or just the person an opportunity to get out there and serve no matter what the level is.
Well, coming back to the original comment about Bill Belichick, Kevin, right now, Steve and I are just focused on the Final Four.
That's right. The gloves are off. That's the new segment here on Monday Night Talk. And Steve and Brian, thank you so much for being a part of the segment.
Thanks for having
us. You got it. All right. We're going to step aside. More Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
All right. Political season is indeed upon us, as you heard that last segment. The gloves are off with Brian and Steve. Well, now we're talking about a couple of local races. Joining us for this segment, we have Mr. John Margie. Mr. Margie is from East Bridgewater, and he is seeking re-election for selectman. Sir, welcome to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you having me on the show. It's a great opportunity for me.
Excellent. And we have Mr. Greg Eaton. Greg is a state rep candidate for the 7th Plymouth District, which is East Bridgewater, most of East Bridgewater, if I'm correct, Whitman, and Abington. Greg, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm looking forward to it.
Oddly enough, I believe Greg was here only in as a shadow not too long ago for an individual who was running for the same seat but has since decided that he's no longer going to campaign. Greg actually has stepped into the fray and decided that he wants to be the next state rep. Is that correct?
It sure is. You know, we were here with Peter and
Peter Drosos. Yep.
Peter was he was on I think back in November or October.
Yeah, not too long ago.
And you know, he just decided in a, he put out a written statement about a month ago now that he was going to not pursue the election. And then I decided after a lot of thought that I would throw my name in the ring. So okay. Here I am.
Excellent. Now, Mr. Margie, you somebody, I believe you're a one-term selectman, but you're somebody who really has cut his teeth for many years on the FinCom.
I have. I started working with the town as a youth leader through most of the 80s and into the 90s for about 16 years, and then in 1996, after that was winding down, I went on the FinCom and spent another 15 years or so on there. It was kind of broken up in the middle when I had to go to work in New Hampshire for a while, but I finished about 15 years. Then I was approached again to run for the Board of Selectmen a couple of years ago, and so I got my first term in, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to do another 3 years.
How do you feel that the serving so many years on the Finance Committee really primed the pump for you to be the next selectman?
I think it's probably the Finance Committee or the Planning Board are one of the two good roads to get into being a town leader. I think you learn a lot about the departments that are in the town based on what they're putting into their budget. When you ask a question, why do you need this money for this to be done, you learn about the programs and the services that that department provides. And when you're looking at the budget of all the departments, you see all the services that the town provides, and you get to learn which ones have priority, which ones are maybe less prioritized, and which ones are important to the citizens.
Okay. Greg, talk to us a little bit about your background, whether it's a political background, appointed to boards, elected, or maybe any civic engagement that you've been involved with that you feel is kind of important to folks knowing that how you're constructed, so to speak, as an individual.
Sure. So I have worked as a freelance video editor for about 10 years. As a video editor in the freelance world, I know that you know this, Kevin, but a lot of listeners don't. In the freelance world, you're basically running your own business, and you're not only worried about your budgets, but you're also worried about your clients' budgets and schedules. So a lot of that, I think, will transition over nicely to this position that I'm running for now.
Okay.
As far as at the town level, I don't have as much experience as I would like, but I'm doing my best to surround myself with people like Mr. Margie that have years of experience. I'm doing my best to get to as many school committee meetings as I can and Board of Selectmen and surround myself with the right people to catch myself up on things like that.
So here's the important question from just it's a selfish question, Mr. Margie, if you don't mind me asking him this. What's your software of choice?
Oh, I'm a Premiere guy.
You're a Premiere guy?
Yep. How about you?
I have it on my laptop, so I play with it from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm kind of I like Media Composer. Mm. It's okay if you're an avid guy. And I'm actually getting up to, well, I shouldn't say getting up to speed. For a long time, if you're going to make me come out of the closet, I'm a Final Cut guy.
Yeah, so I cut my teeth on Final Cut, and then I had to learn Avid real quick.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you can attest to the fact that that's not the easiest thing in the world to do. So if I could do that, then I should be able to jump right into the State House without an issue.
Yeah. While they all have the same similar features, timelines, and everything, depending on the pull downs and applications and how you add in your transitions and see what happened, John. I just went right off the rails here.
That's all right.
We've completely jettisoned from the political topics, so maybe we'll get back on topic now.
We will get back. We will. But Final Cut 10 right now is the one that I'm really getting involved with motion, and it's they've completely changed the platform. But another conversation for another day.
Yeah.
We'll have to have you in with your other hat.
Yeah, I'll come back. I promise.
All right. So back to Mr. Margie. And thank you for letting me take a quick detour off of the side road. What do you feel are the major issues in the community? Because there's been many over the years, whether it's when you guys built your new junior and senior high school, to the community center that you now have, to folks wondering how fiscally sound the community was. How do you feel the issues have changed and where they're at now?
I think the number one issue is always money. The budget is the primary issue, and that's one of the reasons that my finance background is helpful. I've worked with the principals. I mean, East Bridgewater went through a tough time from 2013 to 2016, with budget deficits in one of the major departments that kind of hurt the town. They'd have to make up the difference at the end of the year. There was a lot of back and forth between department heads about, you know, where the responsibility lied and what needed to be done. And I think in the last couple of years, we've kind of brought people together. Going into last year's budget at the town meeting, we had a meeting the night before on that Sunday night and kind of came to agreement on what we could put together before the town for a budget, and along with the finance committee, of course. And that day, at the town meeting, the five major department heads, the Board of Selectmen, Finance Committee, stood together on the town hall floor to say, you know, we're united, we're going to work together. We pledged to work on a budget task force where we met every other week through the course of the summer months and came up with a education program so that everybody was level setting on what a budget, what went into a budget and what needed to come out of it. And I think as a part of that, we did some team building and relationships grew a bit closer with the leadership across the departments. And I think we're much more united with this. We changed a little bit of the budget process based upon what we learned. Think we're coming out of it with a good process.
Okay. I guess I would ask you, Greg, where do you stand in trying to get the campaign up and running and gather intel? Because you're going to find that you have three communities that, while you know they may say that finances are, it's a big thing, and they're going to look for you if you go up to the State House to bring the bacon home. State aid is local aid looms large for communities like East Bridgewater, like Whitman, which shares a school district, in Abington. What are you doing to kind of get up to speed as to what each individual community in your district will need from you as an elected official?
So, I mean, the biggest thing, I think, from what all the conversations I've had with the selectmen and the school committee so far is right now it's budget season, so everyone's worried about how they're going to fund next year's, you know, municipal activities. So right now everyone's worried about the money angle of things. And from what I can understand, it seems like we're not getting enough in local aid, and the schools are putting a huge burden on all of the local towns.
Right.
Every one of them. Yep. It doesn't matter who I talk to in Abington, Whitman, or East Bridgewater. All three, they have major issues trying to fund the schools, and as a result of funding the schools, they're having issues funding the town. So I think that has to be my first priority when I get up there, is to look at Chapter 70 and figure out how to get more money back here. And I hear that it will not be a small task, because I hear that people have been trying to do it for 20 years. Our Chapter 70 funding formula was written in 1993, and every year people try and put legislation forward to move it into the 21st century.
Right.
And no one wants to budge.
Right. When you're talking about 1993, that was the Ed Reform Act of 1993, where Brockton actually led the charge with a lawsuit, equity in education lawsuit, to get changes to the funding formula. It hasn't been changed in that long. And it's interesting, and talking about education and getting funding, I know that the state rep that is running for U.S. Senate, Jeff Deal, was one of a couple of Senate of representatives who actually was successful a couple of years ago in getting the governor to raise his per pupil amount per student from $20 per pupil to $55. What do you feel needs to be done to be able to have it where it stays at that, if not, it exceeds it for all communities, not just, of course, you're going to care about your district, but the other 351 communities in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, I think we have to really comb through that budget and make sure that we're not spending money that's unnecessary for programs that are unnecessary. And one that comes to mind is MassHealth. I mean, $1.8 billion is spent on MassHealth. Where's that money going? Who's it going to? I think that that is where we need to focus. That is, I believe, roughly half of our budget at a state level.
I'll ask you, Mr. Margie, again, somebody, a FinCon member, somebody who is now Board of Selectmen seeking a second term town meeting. Talk to me about the art of town meeting and some of the things that you've been able to accomplish as a FinCon member and as a Board of Selectmen, you know, as far as putting forth information to residents, whether it's for an override, whether it's for passing a town budget. So it's something that's ready to go as of July 1st.
Well, at the beginning of the process, you need to get the people to come together as a group and agree on what it's going to be. Like what we went through last year, where it was come down to the night before the meeting, it was hard to do that, and we came into the town meeting united as leaders, but we didn't know for sure where the community would be with the information that we put forth. So the idea is, and this is why we moved our process back a couple of months, so that we will have more information available to get out to the public prior to the town meeting and be able to educate them about the priorities of the budget, where the money is going to and why it's going to where it is going to.
If you could kind of put your first term into perspective, what do you feel are some of the things that you were able to accomplish, that you were able to do as an elected official, whether it's somebody who called you up and had a particular problem and you were able to guide them through the process, whether it wasn't something you could make a decision, but guide them through the process or be able to lead an effort somehow in the town?
First thing is what I worked on was kind of bringing the community of leaders together, and we did that through the budget process. In addition to that, we've done had a couple of initiatives to increase the capital tax base. We did a TIF agreement with the 47 brand company. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They do the Red Sox hats and all the Major League hats, where they come into the town into a 500,000 square foot warehouse that was really less than half used but with a couple of short-term leases and had a $2.5 million tax rebate cap or tax reduction cap from the state tax board on it, reducing its valuation. And we did a tax increment financing agreement with them, so they bought the building for $15 million. They plan to bang out the whole 500,000 square feet and potentially expand onto the grounds.
Wow.
They're going to they've guaranteed jobs for people from East Bridgewater over the next few years, so there's nothing but goodness there. And the great news is as of July 1st, they've knocked about $2 million, added $2 million onto their valuation, which goes back into the capital tax base. Then we had another thing called the Hanson Land. It's an interesting story where lots of land in East Bridgewater, 100 square foot or 1,000 square foot lots of land, were used as prizes at the Brockton Fair. So hundreds of people won all these little square lots in the woods in East Bridgewater, and nothing ever happened with them. And over the years, people lost track of who owned the lots, and the land tax rules have not included this land for decades. So in 2008, we passed something at the town meeting to do a tax taking, but it needed approval at the legislature, which was completed in 2012. Then, of course, there was litigation after that. And as of January 31st, we sold off 30-plus of the acres there, brought in $395,000 to the town, put the land back on the tax rolls, and already started collecting taxes on this industrial zone land.
How important is that? You know, I've had many conversations with depending on the community, depending on if it's a community that has more residential than commercial. When you look at East Bridgewater, where does East Bridgewater stand in as far as the balance for the tax base? And how important is it to bring in companies like 47 Brand to come in and offer that revenue so that you keep the taxes low?
It's very important, Kevin. I think one of the great things is, you know, to answer your question, I think we're about 90-10 residents to commercial. And the good thing about this is we're a small town environment. We like to keep that small town look when we talk about bringing businesses in, and you bring the wrong type in, people get upset. But 47 Brands sitting in an old warehouse where it always was, their traffic in and out is by UPS and FedEx, so you don't have trucks coming in all night long, so it's even better than Shaw's was when it was there.
Quality of life.
Right, quality of life is great, and I think that helps, and I think, you know, the industrial zone land is out away from most of the residential people, and I think that's just going to be helpful to everybody without interfering with that small town environment.
Okay, we're speaking with John Margi, who is running for a selectman, a re-election this coming Saturday. And we have Mr. Greg Eaton, who is running for state rep in the 7th Plymouth District. They are my guest for this segment. Greg, I turn to you. And what, since you've announced that you're going to be running, what have you heard from voters? What are voters saying to you, some of the needs and the wants, and what they feel some of your priorities should be?
Yeah, all right. So a lot of times you hear a lot about the money. I mean, it's how can we keep taxes low? How can we keep the property taxes low? And that goes right back to what John was just talking about with bringing in more commercial tax base. All three towns that I'm going to represent with any luck have very low commercial tax bases. So how can we bring in more commercial tax so that we can offset some of the burden on the property owners? The South Field project over in Abington, it's mostly in Weymouth, but what people don't understand is that there's a part of that that's in Abington.
Correct.
And there's been several people that have been set up to go in there, and then the project's disappeared. For years, we've been hearing that they were going to put something in there, and then the project would disappear. And we heard the last case was with Amazon. That was one of their prime choices, and now they've chosen to go somewhere else. If we can find someone to go into that, then that's going to offset a lot of the tax burden for the people of Abington. It's going to also increase the people in Whitman and the surrounding areas, because those people that go to work there are going to need someplace to live. So that's one of the things that I think that not only the selectmen and the finance committees on the three towns can work on, but that is something that I can work on with those people to try and find some way to increase the commercial tax base.
Okay. Question that I can ask both of you, and you both can give your independent answers here, where we've got just a couple of minutes left here. This is probably a question I didn't ask you, but you feel is kind of, it's the top of your list of things that you want to make sure that you get out to your prospective voters. John, with you, with your election coming up later this week, I'm sure there's something that I didn't ask you, but you want to make sure that you say to the listeners. Greg, with yours down the road in September, I'm sure there's something you want to at least get out there and somebody will be able to, you know, understand. What would you say is the one thing that you'd want to say to the voters out there right now, John?
I would just want to remind them that I am retired, and so I am a full-time selectman available to the town 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, and we do have opportunities and things that we need to do where we meet during the day versus at night, and I understand not everybody can get to those meetings, but again, nobody can get to all the nighttime meetings either. So any meetings we have are posted as according to open meeting law. And I think it's helpful for the town. We've had emergencies where we've had to meet to get things done, and there was no time to get them done, waiting for another biweekly Monday night meeting or things like that. So I think it's critical, and I've done things like I've toured other libraries to see, you know, we're talking about a new library in East Bridgewater, see how that they've gone through the process, gone to training from the state and things like that, that if I had had a full-time job, I would not be able to take advantage of those opportunities. So I'm available.
Greg, if you will, if there's anything that I haven't asked or that you feel is kind of important.
So I would say that the one thing is that along with the commercial tax base and keeping the tax base low, the thing that probably I'm most passionate about is the opioid crisis. It has hit the three towns especially hard. I'm not going to go into my whole spiel about my plan for it, but if you want to find out more information, you can find it out on gregeaton7th.com. There I have a full plan laid out on how I'd proceed and how we can better tackle this crisis.
And if I can ask real quick, is 7th spelled or is it 7th?
7th.
Okay, just want to make sure. And Mr. Margi, if folks want to find out more about you, how can they do that?
John Margi, East Bridgewater Selectman on Facebook is my page.
Okay, excellent. Gentlemen, you've been both great. I appreciate you coming and being a part of the program this evening. And folks, remember, it's up to you to get out and vote and make the decisions. Listen to what the candidates have to offer, whether they're an incumbent, whether they're somebody who's running for office, whether it's their first time running for office. Listen to everybody, whether they're a D, an R, or an independent. Give everybody an opportunity, hear what they have to say, and then make your judgment. And that's what we try to do here on Monday Night Talk, is bring folks in, as many as we can. We can't get everybody in, but we try. So you at least get a little bit of a head start on when you go in and pull that curtain to check off a ballot. So we are going to step aside, and we got special guests. Remember I teased it earlier on in the program? That's right. We're going to talk a little NASCAR. Larry McReynolds is going to be our guest in just a moment here on Monday Night Talk. Stay tuned.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. We have a fantastic conversation coming up. The NASCAR season is heating up, but just in time for National Car Care Month. Joining us today is legendary NASCAR crew chief and broadcaster Larry McReynolds, who knows a few things about taking care of cars. McReynolds, who has nearly, actually, 4 decades worth of experience, has been the crew chief for greats like Ernie Irvin, Davey Allison, and the great Dale Earnhardt Sr., guiding Earnhardt to his first and only Daytona 500 victory. Now, as an announcer, Larry Mack is a lead NASCAR analyst for Fox. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, Mr. McReynolds.
Oh, thank you for having me, Kevin. Appreciate it.
I will tell you that I'm not a full-time NASCAR fan, but I am somebody who dabbles in the sport from time to time. So I'm looking forward to having a good conversation and even kind of finding out from you, just to kind of get things started. What is it like? What are the keys to being able to produce a winning NASCAR ride?
Well, I was so fortunate, Kevin, throughout my career to be involved with some great race car drivers. You named a few of them and some great race teams. But like any other business, a great race team, a good winning race team is about the people. But at the end of the day, it's a lot like your passenger car. It's about good maintenance on that race car, knowing that you're going to put that car on the track. And at a lot of tracks we go to, like the upcoming race at Texas Motor Speedway, that driver's going to drive off in that corner at over 200 miles per hour.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. We here are hoping that spring is going to show up eventually, but where do we start? Where do we start when it comes to spring car care checkups?
Yeah, I believe back in early February, Kevin, the old groundhog, he was more than right on Groundhog Day.
Yep.
But, yeah, no matter what the temps are when we get to spring, we think about a lot of rain. And with rain, that puts a premium on your wiper blades. Here's a little interesting stat. 46% of auto accidents occur during rainy, wet weather. Mm-hmm. Just this past weekend up in Martinsville, we not only had to deal with rain on Saturday, we had about 5 to 6 inches of snow. So I highly recommend the Bosch Icon Beam wiper blades. They're going to last about 40% longer than other premium wiper blades, and they're going to provide a lot of safety in those extreme weather conditions.
Well, so other than windshield wipers, what about the value of getting a tune-up for your car in the spring? How important is that?
Well, as a spark plug gets age on it, it's going to hurt engine performance, and it's going to hurt fuel mileage. And we all think about fuel mileage a lot with the cost of a gallon of gasoline. Now, when I was in racing, working on race cars, we used auto-like spark plugs, and we would change them after every practice session. That's a little bit extreme. Depending on the vehicle, it can be anywhere from 32,000 up to 120,000 miles. I just encourage you to check your owner's manual when to change those spark plugs. But when you do change, I strongly recommend Autolite Iridium spark plugs. They're going to upgrade the performance of the engine and the fuel efficiency with that Autolite Iridium XP that's involved.
Knowing that your experience spans 4 decades, I mean, how far have we come when it comes to technology for automobiles from when you first started, getting involved and being under the hood and putting cars on the track to what we're seeing these days?
Yeah, I mean, the evolution of the race car and everything about it, Kevin, has been amazing. Probably the biggest thing is for years, ever since I started back in 1980, for a number of years we ran that four-barrel naturally aspirated carburetor. And then a few years ago, NASCAR stepped into electronic fuel injection with the ECU box on the dash. I think that's probably been one of the biggest gains in technology with a NASCAR race car.
Any other special car care tips that you want to share with our listeners here up in Boston?
Yeah, honestly, Kevin, this is an interesting one. I just learned this a few weeks ago, but the good folks at eSurance.com, they want to remind us that a well-maintained car or truck is going to be a lot safer to drive on the roads than one that does not have any maintenance at all. And believe it or not, proper car maintenance can actually save you on your auto insurance. And by avoiding accidents, you can continue those claims-free streak. And if you want to see what that good driving history can do for you, maybe with a new auto policy, I encourage you to go to eSurance.com. That's eSurance.com.
Give me your thoughts on NASCAR this year. I mean, we see a year without Dale Jr. It's been a bit since Jeff Gordon has been in the seat. What is NASCAR like, watch, for you being an analyst?
Well, yeah, we are going through a huge changing of the guard right now. You talked about Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart, Dale Earnhardt Jr., Carl Edwards, Matt Kenseth, all these drivers retiring over the last 2 to 3 years. But, Kevin, when I look at this group of new talent that we've got coming along, it is a long list. You've got Chase Elliott. You've got Ryan Blaney, Eric Jones, Bubba Wallace, who just ran second in the Daytona 500, Austin Dillon, who won the Daytona 500. But, yeah, after six races so far, it's really been all about Stewart Haas Racing. They've won four of our six races. Kevin Harvick won three in a row. And then the surprise winners. We talked about Austin Dillon winning the Daytona 500. Mm-hmm. Clint Bowyer for Stewart Haas Racing. He had not won a race in over 5 years, and he just won the recent race at Martinsville. So I look at 2018. Yeah, it's about the young talent. But I think we're going to have a multitude of winners this year, and I think we're going to have more surprise winners as we move forward.
Do you like the point system? Do you like the stages that take place within the race, which is, again, it's vastly different from when you were prominent back, 20 years ago?
No, I do like the stage racing. This is the second year that we've had it. And you know, I wanted to see how it went before I made a call whether it was going to be better or worse. And I've got to say, it's been a huge improvement, because not that these guys needed incentive, Kevin, to race harder. I think they've always raced hard. But I think now they're racing differently in the early stages of the race, because they know at the end of those first two stages that there's points available that can certainly lead to putting you in contention to make the playoffs and win a championship.
Again, we're speaking with the legendary NASCAR crew chief broadcaster Larry McReynolds. Before I let you go, I got to give you a moment to maybe beam a little bit about the offspring. Your son Brandon is somebody who is in NASCAR. How's he doing?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking about Brandon. Yeah, he'll be 27 years old coming up here in May, and we've been racing him ever since he was 7 years old, and it's a pretty vertical mountain. You know, unfortunately, Kevin, your racing resume doesn't mean near as much as your financial statement. If you've got a sponsor or money to bring, you can pretty much write your ticket, but we're fortunate enough to be involved with John Visconti Motorsports out of Long Island. He's running some K&N East races, and actually here in a couple of weeks, they're going to be up at Bristol running the K&N East car after the Xfinity Series race on Saturday. So we feel fortunate to have any racing whatsoever. I'm very proud of the young man. It seems like whatever he climbs in, he finds success. But I'm probably more proud of the person he represents outside the race car.
But I have to ask, as a dad myself, was there any part of you that was kind of hoping that he'd want to be under the hood, that he'd want to have the wrench in his hand or kind of get involved with the technology and not so much have the wheel in his hand?
I just wanted him to be happy with whatever he was pursuing. And the good thing about Brandon, if it does not work out for a driving career in NASCAR, I think maybe because of how I brought him up, making him work on his race cars since, again, he was 7 years old, probably other than build an engine or a transmission, there's not much else that he cannot do on a race car. So if the driving does not work out, I definitely see a future on the other side of the sport possibly for him.
Last question I'll ask you before, well, second to last question I'll ask you, and that is driver and crew to watch for 2018?
We can't take our eye off our reigning champion, Martin Truex Jr. in that 78 car. They've already won a race this year. He and crew chief Cole Pern, what they did last year was amazing. But based on what I saw in these first few races, I go back to our 2014 champion, Kevin Harvick, his crew chief, Rodney Childers. I think their second year with Ford, already winning three races out of the first six, I think they're going to be a force to reckon with the entire season.
And again, I want to thank you for joining us, talking a little bit about National Car Cam Month. If folks want to get a little bit more info on what you and I discussed, where can they go, my friend?
Yeah, Kevin, there's a lot of places to go, but one I really enjoy going to is tipsontv.com. That's tipsontv.com.
There he is, the one and only legendary NASCAR crew chief broadcaster, Larry McReynolds. Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Wow, there we go. Larry Mack, Larry McReynolds, being our guest here on Monday Night Talk. Fantastic way to end our program this evening. And if you've missed any of our great segments tonight, and we've had some good information, some good conversation, you can always go to the podcast site, I admit. I am a couple of podcasts behind, but we are working diligently behind the scenes to edit and put them up. And those are available not only on the website, 959WATD.com, but are available in iTunes. You can go into the podcast section, download Monday Night Talk. The other thing is any suggestions for this radio program? Guests that you'd like to hear, conversation you want to hear, maybe a topic or an issue that you feel that would be great to hear. Maybe you're an elected official or an individual whose community is dealing with an issue or a problem that you feel would be great to have a conversation, not only in studio, but maybe even welcome callers. Feel free to drop me a line at Monday Night Talk. That's right, Monday Night Talk at gmail.com. It's that easy. And we'll get right back to you as soon as you send along that correspondence. Folks, that's all the program that we have for you this evening as we step aside. Up next, South Shore Live with Stan and the Gang coming up. But until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great evening. You've been listening to Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.